the Richard Nixon Experience.
Secondly, wrongly, they thought Nixon would be eager, even though he's going to win anyway, eager to have a peace agreement before the election if he possibly could. Therefore, he might be more flexible. Mm-hmm. Nixon was just the opposite. He was damned if he was going to have any agreement that looked like a sellout just to get reelected. He had a man of principle, and he wasn't going to do it, and he didn't need it for the election.
Although the October date is kind of an interesting coincidence compared to the experience 4 years before. I mean, one of the things I've learned from the Vietnam negotiations is if you can at all avoid it, don't negotiate something critical to United States national security 1 month before a presidential election.
Yeah.
Depends on my condition.
Right.
I went to the ball game yesterday, and I stayed up all night and had a doctor out in San Antonio.
Look, your team won.
Yes, we had a wonderful
game. I saw that game on television. Texas came back and won.
I pay for it every time, though, I do.
Yeah. Thanks. I know you yell, don't you?
A little bit.
Yeah.
And then I had to say I've had heart pains all night.
Oh, boy, have you?
Yes.
Goodness, I called you at the wrong time. I hope
not at all.
I'm
cured. I want to hear from
you. Let me tell you this. I still have that invitation for you to go down and use that place in Florida, because old BB is a great guy to have around. He cheers people up, you know. He never brings up any unpleasant subjects.
Come see me. I'll make you see him.
All right. Well, it's good to talk to you, and give our best to Lady Bird and to the girl. Also to that little boy, that future president I had in here. Will you give him my best?
I sure will.
Him not to run till he's 35.
I'll do it, Mr. President, and best wishes to you.
Okay.
Let me know if I can help you anyway. I know you do the best you can.
Sure. Oh, it'll come out. Thank you.
Bye.
Welcome to Bridging the Political Gap. This is Randall Wallace, and you were just listening to President Lyndon Johnson and President Nixon discussing the Truman private or the official ceremony that was going to be held, a memorial service in Washington, D.C. They had both gone and laid wreaths at when Mr. Truman was at his library, and but they were coordinating whether or not they were going to go, and they had nice little chat there. But this is a significant phone call because it is the last one, and with President Johnson, and to hear them talk that final time on the 3rd of January of 1973. So as we close in on January 73, now Henry Kissinger and Al Haig and a group of our negotiators are going to go back to the table in the early part of the month, like about the 7th, 8th, the 9th, I believe, is when they officially get together in Paris to start negotiating an end to the Vietnam War after a very tense couple of weeks with the Christmas bombing. And you're going to hear some phone calls now between Henry Kissinger and President Nixon, and then President Nixon and Alexander Haig as they prepare for the meeting.
Hello? Henry? Mr. President, where'd they get you at home?
No, I'm going to Joe Alsop's. He's giving a dinner for General Abrams.
Oh, I see.
I'm in my office still.
Right. How'd you get along with Scott and Ford?
Oh, very well. Very well. And Ford is really steamed up now. And he has a resolution which I worked out with him and Anderson and Ahrens, which the House caucus, he thinks, is going to pass overwhelmingly tomorrow.
Right.
Which is
What I want you to do tomorrow with Mansfield, and you're not going to like this, but I want you to do it, is to tell him, and very coldly, you've talked to the president tonight, and after the Senate indication that they'd cut off funds on the 20th, that the president, that we, as he tried to tell Mansfield when he met with him, that the hopes were that, and this has probably torpedoed the hopes for the things, and the Senate, the president will go on television on Wednesday or Thursday this week to tell him so, tell the nation so.
To torpedo what?
The negotiations.
The negotiations.
I want you to play a very hard line with him, very cold. Say, Senator, I regret to say that we had it made. You know what I mean?
Right.
That we had what I mean is that we feel we had a very good chance. Your resolution now has cooled it off, and the president is going to go on national television. He regrets doing it because of his great personal affection for you, but he's going to have to say this. Scare the shit out of him. Now, I want you to do that, because
I don't mind doing it at all.
We've got to do it, Henry.
We've
got to start playing the game a little bit stronger than we've been playing it.
Did he put in a resolution today?
Well, the Star tonight has a thing that the Senate will cut off funds on January 20th.
Yeah. I didn't see it. I'll have to take a look, but I'll say it anyway.
Right.
Independent. I just didn't know specifically to what you were referring.
That's right. See what I mean?
Yeah.
I just want you to say, Senator, I regret to say, but your resolution probably has destroyed the chance for an honorable peace. Now, the president, and you can just say that you have no other choice but to advise the president to go on television and to point this out when you return.
Right.
If it fails. Put it that way. See?
Right.
So that he knows that it's all him. And be very cold and very tough with him. Not a bit conciliatory. Don't give him an inch.
I was at your reception today, very cold to him.
But I want him to be coldly treated in the morning. I would be icy and say that, I'm sorry, Senator, but I think you, I regret to say you've torpedoed the negotiations and that you are going to have to advise the President to go on and say so. And the President, you've talked to him. He says, I regret to say that I'm going to have to do it.
Absolutely. I think that's...
And then, of course, that comes out, that's something very different.
That's what I meant to suggest this morning. That doesn't bother me a bit.
Right.
Not a bit.
No.
You've been overly generous to these people.
Right. Tonight, with these people, I'd play a very confident, cool, calm line, you know?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Not optimistic, but just say, we don't know what's going to happen, but by God, we know what we're doing, and this is unconscionable and wrong and so forth. Okay?
Absolutely, Mr. President.
Okay, Henry.
All right, Mr. President.
Hello.
Mr. President?
You finished your lunch?
Yes, I have.
Oh, you're still there?
No, I'm still in the... No, I'm in the office.
Oh, fine. How'd it go? Anything new?
Nothing new, because we talked mostly. This was scheduled to discuss other matters.
Right.
Vietnam.
Right.
He hadn't had a report yet, or just said he hadn't had a report from Lee Duck-so visiting to Moscow. But apparently these guys lie to them so much that he's totally confused as to what the issues are.
Huh. All right.
He listed a whole batch of them that were already settled. So I sent him some more pages from a protocol just to let they know. And then most of the rest he discussed with European Security Conference, mutual balance, force reduction. And I take the position on all of this, but frankly, as long as Vietnam is going on, I just can't turn to it effectively.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
This is a way of keeping us...
Yeah. Well, you know, you really come down to the point, Henry, as to whether the Chinese and the Russians really are gonna put a little pressure on them or not. I don't know. They
sure the Chinese are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it just isn't in the Chinese interest to have the Russians.
Yeah.
It is two things aren't in the Chinese interest. One, they don't want Vietnam unified under Hanoi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And two, they don't want Russian influence to predominate in Hanoi.
Yep.
But I think that message from Cho is...
Well, that does seem to me to have some significance.
They do not talk lightly. Now, Lee Duck-so arrived today in Paris and made a blood-curdling statement.
What?
That this was going to be the last attempt. Now, that's actually quite good. A, we've already told him it's the last attempt, so he's taking again a free ride like with the Enterprise.
He says what?
That it's going to be our final attempt.
Uh-huh.
Which is what we had already told him first.
Yeah.
But that has an advantage because, at least it means he can't be stalling whatever else he's doing.
Uh-huh.
And he said, if the United States changes are not unreasonable, if we insist on unreasonable changes, they won't agree. Which suggests that if we insist on reasonable ones, they will agree. And we aren't insisting on any right now.
We're not insisting on any changes, are we?
No.
I don't think. I don't know.
No, we don't. No.
But it's they that they're insisting on the changes, aren't they, Henry?
Exactly.
It may be, of course, that he's referring to it. No, anyway, you're all
right. No, I think he's just making a statement.
One thing about it, sometimes I wonder if our restraint and our public statements may be misinterpreted to them. You know, they play everything up to the propaganda hilt, and we refuse to talk and so forth. What do you think?
I don't think so. They have been pretty restrained, except he couldn't let this opportunity go by arriving at the airport.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thing I want to tell you, adding to it, needless to say, in the course of these meetings, if you need to say that you have just received a message from me or, you know, anything, you feel free to use one, you know?
Right.
You know the various things we've covered, and they're all there. So you just pull out anytime you want. You pull out a piece of paper and say, well, I just got this message. I've, you know, okay?
Right.
Or ask for one anytime you need one, so that, because
takes on the lunch.
Yeah.
Hello?
Hi, Al.
Yes, sir.
How you like your new job?
Like a fish out of water here at first.
Yeah. I was thinking that if you haven't done so, you might give Henry a call before he leaves and, you know, buck him up a little.
Oh, right, sir. As a matter of fact, I've just spoken to him.
Oh, good. He's all right. I mean, I saw him this morning, but, you know, he's carrying a heavy load, and he's more susceptible to the congressional actions and also the damn columns and so forth, some of which
they're pretty vicious these days.
Yeah. Well,
he seems pretty pretty good shape.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, sure. He was, we had a good talk today, and he knows what our options are and so forth. And also, despite all the, you know, the yakking around, it seems to me that we have followed the only course of action we could. And and you having been over there, you know, all this nonsense which has been written to the effect that Henry was wanted to continue negotiating, and that I drew him off and decided to bomb. Of course, that's just the other way around, as you know. But nevertheless, he was right, my own feeling is that I'm utterly convinced that had we not done what we'd done, we just have no bargaining chip at all at this point. What do you think?
We would have been stalled out. No question.
Don't you agree? Don't you think so?
That's right.
Yeah. Now, whether this is going to produce a settlement remains to be seen. It could. It could. What's your guess at this moment?
Well, I'm inclined to think they're going to settle. It may be a couple of false starts, but I think by the end of the month we'll have a settlement. That's my own judgment.
Yeah. Well, they
think they want it.
Frankly, they either have to settle or we just have the thing where they have to settle or take some consequences for it. That's what they've got to think in their own minds. Despite what the shenanigans of the Congress, they know we've gone through that before. At least I would think they would remember that.
Well, I think they know it. There's nothing that Congress could do in the immediate sense in any event.
That's right.
And I don't think they'd ever get around to doing it in any event, given the situation. Especially if they've
stonewalled, that's right.
And then we just have to go out and lay it out.
That's right. That's right. Well, my feeling is, too, that I've never been, as you know, much of an optimist about settlement, but I think at this point the chances are much better for settling than they were when he went over there in late November.
Yes, sir.
December, don't you think so?
I think so.
Because then I think they were sort of floating along there with the assumption that we sort of had to, and they didn't.
Exactly.
They weren't hurting too much.
Now I think they realize that the way these congressional things are turning, they're going to end up with a purely military option, which they don't want.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. If they don't want a military option, they'll damn well better settle now, because that's the way the Congress would force us to move.
That's exactly right.
And, of course, as you know, it's the way we will move, too, on our own, without telling them. In any event, we'll keep him bucked up and hope for the best. As you know, if we do get any kind of a breakthrough, you'll have to get in your horse and go out and see Brother Chu again.
Yes, sir. I'm off.
This time, though, there's no nonsense. And I think he's going to have to. He'll be in a different mood too. That's my guess.
I think so.
We've had some indications, apparently, as you know, that he's changing his mind.
Well, that's the benefit of this activity, if there is any. He at least learned a lesson.
Well, when he sees the Congress jumping up and down, he knows that after the stop of all military activity, the next stop all aid is South Vietnam in order to get the prisoners back. That's the next step. And you know that's exactly where that road's going to lead.
That's right.
That's the reason it isn't a very good one for us either.
No.
Because, but in any event, when we go this time, if it comes to that point, whatever the settlement is, we're just going to put it right to him. That's it, and then he takes it or leaves it.
I think that's the only alternative.
Don't you agree?
Yes, I do, and even if we have to go public,
we will.
You'll knuckle.
All right. Okay, we hope you take the trip. Okay,
yes, bye. Yes, sir, Mr. President. I want...
As we prepare... prepare to head for Paris for the peace talks, I thought it was kind of important that we look back over what has been a long process. They had been meeting in Paris through two administrations, as a presentation we're getting ready to show you, we'll go through it. President Johnson began these Paris peace talks, Henry Cabot Lodge, going back to the middle 60s. And so you've got history here where you're meeting and talking with the folks in Hanoi. And so we're going to take a look now at leading up to where we are in January of 1972, as we are in that final stages of the end game of the Vietnam War.
In Paris, on Avenue Kléber, in a former Gestapo headquarters, politicians have been talking for 4 years about ending a war. Once a week, on Thursdays, diplomatic cars arrive at the conference center, bringing delegates to talk about a war in which nearly 1 million men have died, the Vietnam War. From North Vietnam, Mr. Xuan Thuy. He arrived in May 1968 when the talks opened. Since then, he and his colleagues have been joined by representatives of the Viet Cong, led by Madam Thái Bình. From the United States, Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge, one of a list of high-level diplomats who have handled the grueling negotiations on behalf of the nation most anxious for peace in Indochina. And inside the conference chamber, already at the table, Mr. Pham Dang Lam from South Vietnam. In over 150 such meetings, what have they achieved? This week, ECHO re-examines the prospects for peace in Vietnam. The truth of the matter is that the Paris peace talks, hailed as a major breakthrough in 1968, have by 1972 achieved nothing. The delegates still turn up, make accusatory speeches, and leave. But it's a game of which even the international press has grown weary. Talks, which began in farce with arguments about the shape of the conference table, have degenerated into sterile tragedy. Week in, week out, the delegates play their parts. But it's all become nothing more than a puppet show without an audience. And there's nothing to comment on anymore. Everything that could be said in public has been said. And in the meantime, the war goes on and the casualty lists mount. For the reality of Vietnam is 10,000 miles from this place. And yet in other parts of Paris, secret meetings between Americans and North Vietnamese did attempt to break the deadlock. The American initiative was led by President Nixon's special advisor, Dr. Henry Kissinger. Since 1970, he has met North Vietnamese leaders 12 times. At their meetings, he offered much of what the communists demanded, the withdrawal of American forces and new elections in South Vietnam. But all offers were rejected or ignored, and the whole American formula publicly rebutted by Hanoi. This is South Vietnam. To take a realistic view of this country is to recognize that peace is as far away as ever. In truth, there can never be peace here as long as the North Vietnamese maintain their efforts to overrun the South. Politically, historically, and ethnically, the North and the South do not mix. They were fighting each other 1,000 years before Vietnam became a household word. And this is the vital factor. Only an inbred antipathy to the North could possibly have sustained the South during the past decade. But even a massive commitment to war cannot obscure South Vietnam's growth. For example, it depends on rice. During the worst of the war, production slumped, but has been revitalized, so that this country now grows 6 million tons annually, enough to feed its people without imports. New agricultural techniques, along with new strains of rice plant, have taken root in the paddy fields. The acreage under irrigation will double in the next 4 years. Additionally, a third of a million peasants have been given their own land in a program of agrarian reform. Equally important, there is in South Vietnam a willingness to unify. Villagers, aided by the military, are building bridges to link with other villages, where once they remained isolated and suspicious, and easy prey to Viet Cong guerrillas. The result is closer contact with the capital, Saigon. The Mekong River connects South Vietnam with the outside world, serving as an artery for the nation's trade and commerce. Intense development of the port of Saigon has made it the biggest and most efficient trading port between Singapore and Hong Kong. Formerly only handling the massive inflow of men and material needed for the war, it has now switched to more peaceful uses. More than 8 million tons of cargo are handled annually in Saigon, a port of call for nearly 6,000 ships every year. Goods are moved quickly along the waterways flowing into the Mekong and on the new highways, first built to transport the paraphernalia of war. But with the noise of battle receding to South Vietnam's borders, the work of reconstruction gathers momentum. Schools and hospitals have doubled in number during the past 5 years. Then there were no medical centers in the villages. Now there are over 400. War has taught the South Vietnamese about electricity supply and the need to modernize peasant industry. And it has taught them a lot of other things too. Nobody under the age of 30 in South Vietnam knows what it is like to live under any but wartime conditions. Nobody has ever asked them what they want. If they were asked, their answer would probably be nothing more ambitious than to be left alone in peace. What they have learned is that even when fighting an endless war, they can equip themselves for peace, should it ever come. But will it ever come? The answer lies in the tortured thinking of the men in Hanoi and Peking. What South Vietnam has achieved, it has had to achieve while committing a million of its best young men to fighting a war from which their American support is being gradually withdrawn. To the Americans, the name of the game is Vietnamization. It means simply equipping South Vietnam to fight its own battles. With American air support, South Vietnamese troops are still engaged in the endless, weary, bloody business of war. The North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong are still there, and they will not go away until or unless politicians tell them to do so. And all efforts at peace having founded on the intractability of the communist side, there would seem to be little hope of peace. For this is a war that nobody can win. Only losers. To date, South Vietnam has lost 145,000 troops and untold thousands of civilians. They claim the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong have lost twice as many. The Americans have lost 46,000 killed. In all, nearly a million men. That is the background to all the talks and secret negotiations in Paris, 10,000 miles from where the action is. And yet, if that talking has achieved nothing, at least the South Vietnamese can claim some victories. Most important of all, they have survived.
This is Randall Wallace, your host for Bridging the Political Gap. I want to thank you first for tuning in to our podcast and invite you to come to our website, randallwallace.com. There you can get a copy of our book, Always Vote Your Conscience, Don't Take It Personally, and Don't Fight the Same Old Battles Over and Over Again, with a lot of policy suggestions and things that I think everyone could embrace, an argument for why we need to be working together instead of fighting with each other. Also, you can take a look at the first 11 episodes of this podcast, which was a podcast documentary that looked at the World War II generation of bipartisan leadership that built the American century and the lessons we can learn from them to apply to today's situations. Again, thanks for tuning in to our podcast. And if you've enjoyed our show, please leave us a review at wherever you get your podcast. And now, let's get back to the show.
After the Christmas bombing, the first day that Lyndon Carr and Kissinger had the meet in Paris, after shaking hands, Kissinger had told Lyndon Carr that I am very sorry, I could not prevent the decision of bombing up to North Vietnam in Christmas Day. So the editor say that I know who are responsible. All you are responsible, and you are criminals.
Publicly, he refused to shake hands with me, and in all the pictures that were taken, he never appeared with me, but inside the negotiating room, he moved at tremendous speed and with as much human warmth as he was capable of generating towards a representative of the capitalist system.
It was a very somber meeting. No jollity, no joking, as usually went on. And whenever points were pressed, and we seemed to be at a point of suggesting that our patience was running thin, they either made a concession there or moved rapidly on to something else and set that aside.
So here we are, near the end of this horrible war that had so divided America. And what we have here for coming up is a symposium that was put together by the Richard Nixon Presidential the Foundation and the National Archives. In it, you're going to have Winston Lord, who is a negotiator on Henry Kissinger's staff, John Negroponte, also one of the negotiators on the staff, and Dick Smizer, also on that staff. And then it's going to be moderated by Mrs. McFarland, who is a Fox News analyst who worked with these guys. And so this is a pretty enlightening conversation, and it will go through everything that happened going into this last set of negotiations. And then finally, they're going to talk a little bit about the lessons of Vietnam And as we end this look at 1972, I think it's pretty important to hear what these folks did, how they dealt with this horribly divisive situation, and dealing with communists who were dug in, and frankly, we had a lot of problems coming out of South Vietnam, as we've already alluded to get them to make a deal. So here, let's listen to these three men who were intimately involved with negotiating the end of the Vietnam War. And then finally, we close out our look at 1972 by Time Magazine's awarding of the Men of the Year Award in 1972 to President Richard Nixon and his National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger.
That's right. And so critics could say that we rushed it, and John might have, you know, he may want to comment on that as we get further on. But in any event, we spent 3 days, exhausting days, fleshing out our counterproposal. I remember one night, John, we were staying, I guess, at the embassy. I don't know where we were at that point, because this was public now. And Henry said, take their proposal and redo it. So John and I stayed up until 3 a.m., did the proposal. Henry woke us up. He was generous that night. He didn't wake us until about 7 a.m., I think. So he wakes us up and says, this is too tough. I think that's probably Necroponte's fault. I don't know whose fault it was. But in any event, he said, it's too tough. We've got to loosen this up a little bit. So we redid it. Anyway, we had 3 or 4 more exhausting days, and we finally settled on the basics of an agreement. There's some details. And Henry was asked to go to Hanoi to complete it, and he was contemplating that. Meanwhile, we were keeping Nixon and President Tu informed, but rounding off some of the edges, not to scare anybody or lock us in. And so we went back to the agreement. I stayed behind for a day with our translator, and I negotiated with the Vietnamese on a lot of details. We made about 65, 70 technical changes. I'm not pretending I was a major negotiator, but it was still harrowing. I thought we had succeeded. I went to bed, and I was woken up by a phone call from Haig the next morning, said, you got to go back to North Vietnamese and get some more points. So anyway, I flew back on a commercial airline. I can still remember it. You got to remember the emotions of this time. I went into the restroom on the plane and sat down and cried, both out of exhaustion and out of joy that we were going to end this damn thing. But then we got back to Washington, and we decided we better go tell Mr. Tu what this agreement's all about. And I'll let John pick it up from there.
Well, then we went to Saigon. I think it was about the 17th of October. And the scenario that Henry had in mind was we'd go to Saigon for a couple of days, and then we would go to Hanoi, initial the agreement, and then the ceasefire would go into effect, I think, on the 2nd of November, something like that. So just several days before the elections. But we, when we got to Saigon, unfortunately, we didn't even have yet a fully completed Vietnamese text. But Tu reacted. I was not at the meeting with Tu. Maybe you were.
On John's behalf, I'm going to interrupt you for your sake. On the way out there, we had discussions on the plane about how Tu is going to react. Henry and I, partly analysis, partly wishful thinking, thought he would not like the agreement, but he would accept it because we got rid of the political condition that he'd be overthrown. He'd still be in office. And in fact, a year before, we had elaborated one of our proposals by saying we're willing to have elections after an agreement. We said this in North Vietnamese, 6 months after agreement, under international supervision, including communist participants in the international body. And that Tu would resign a month before the elections. But we leave the implication that he would still run in the elections. Mm-hmm. He was willing then, this was a year earlier, to actually say, no, I won't even run in the elections. He said, no, that's going too far.
Yeah.
So he was very forthcoming there. So for that reason, we thought he might buy this agreement. Plus, as I say, there were many other reassurances of continuing aid and everything else. John was much more prescient. He predicted a real blow-up in Saigon. I'll let you pick. I just want to make
so you
point.
Think you got a deal after a decade of the Vietnam War, and then you go to
well,
South
yeah,
Vietnam.
I mean, there's not much more to the story. Then what happens is Tu says he won't do it. Then the North Vietnamese reveal the fact, and Henry then cancels his trip to Hanoi to carry out this scenario. Arno de Borgrav at that time writes a story which is headlined in Newsweek magazine, a deal with Hanoi, a duel with Tu, and President Nixon, faced with this situation, decides, I think very correctly, that he couldn't go ahead and forge ahead and sign this agreement in October of 72, it would look like we were really, in a very ungracious way, just dumping an ally who we'd fought side by side with for all these years. So we decided to go back to Washington, and Henry had a press conference on the 26th of October.
First press conference he ever gave.
Memory serves.
Yeah.
And said, peace is at hand, and which was misinterpreted by many of the critics as Henry trying to convince the American people that, trying to deceive them somehow. Whereas what he was really trying to do was to send a message reassuring Hanoi, particularly in my view, and a message to Saigon also to say, okay, we've had this hiccup, but we're going to be back to sort this out after the election.
That's right.
So then you have Nixon's reelected. You don't have a deal. Then what does Nixon do?
Well, we go back with more talks in November in Paris, which got nowhere. Not only did the North Vietnamese not make some changes, we said we had to. When it blew up with Hanoi, we said, look, we've always told you all along we can't do this deal unless South Vietnam is on board, and they're not. We need to make a few changes. Mm-hmm. But as John said, we kept reassuring them the base agreement was in place, and we're reassuring or telling Chu that we're going to try to get some of your changes, but don't expect too much. We're going to stick with this. So we go back. Nothing happens in November. So that gets us to...
All along, we have now decided to really ramp up the supply of the South Vietnamese army so that to bolster their sense of security for any future agreement we might go into.
That's right. We were telling Chu we would, back them up. And anyway, we can get into that. Nixon decides, once again, the only way to get the North Vietnamese attention is some military pressure. So you have the famous Christmas bombing. It literally took place around Christmas time, since the November talks got nowhere. Now, the fact is, you could argue it's not a nice thing to do. The fact is, within 2 days, the North Vietnamese sent us a conciliatory note saying they wanted to talk again. So we got their attention. Furthermore, we really did limit civilian casualties. There are all kinds of horror stories about all these civilian casualties. I'm sure there was, quote, collateral damage, but we did our best to minimize it. And when we went to Hanoi later, a couple months later, we could see that in the populated areas there was no damage. The craters were out in areas that were not near the population. So in any event, that got their attention. We went back to negotiations. They did make some changes, not enough for Tu's sake, but we got the deal.
So and 2 days after the Christmas bombing,
we signed
it.
We have
a
picture of the initialing ceremony that took place at that point, January 23rd, 1972. But why don't you want to add something to it?
Well, I'm...
So this is the initialing ceremony.
Right.
And, where is this taking place?
This is in Paris.
Paris. Do you want to talk us through?
And then there's the International Conference Center, where there's a picture later on of Lê Duc Tho and Henry and others mm-hmm. coming out onto the streets. It's on Avenue Kléber of Paris, France. There you go.
Can you go back to the previous picture? I can explain who's in the picture. On the left-hand side, Ambassador Sullivan, who was negotiating along with the legal advisor of State Department, Kissinger's left,
George Aldrich. Yeah.
George Aldrich. They were negotiating some protocols in Indochina, generally prisoners and supervision. So you have Sullivan, Kissinger, Aldrich, then myself, and then a dour-looking John Negroponte, who was less happy, I think, with the agreement than I was. Yeah. And then our translator, Engel. And then opposite from Henry is Lê Duc Tho with the white hair. To his right, Xuan Thuy. By the way, in our negotiations, whenever Lê Duc Tho showed up, he was number five in their Politburo. We knew it was going to be fairly serious. If it was just Xuan Thuy, who was a functionary and a vice minister of foreign affairs, we knew it wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. So that's who is on the other side, along with their foreign minister to Lê Duc
Tho. And in that conversation, I recall one thing that Henry asked Lê Duc Tho, which I thought was quite revealing. He said, do you decide these issues in the Politburo by consensus or by vote? And I was sure he was going to say by consensus, because that's sort of the way the communists work. At least that's my perception of things. And he said, no, by vote, which I thought was pretty interesting. And I think they had actually genuinely been divided in the weeks preceding mm-hmm. about whether or not to go forward with the agreement, because they felt they'd been double-crossed by us bailing out on the original scenario and then resupplying Saigon with all this equipment. I think there was some, might have been some dissension in the Politburo about whether to go forward or not, which is why he then, just before Christmas, said he had to go back. And I think the reason he introduced so many, he introduced a whole bunch of changes, 9 or 10 changes in the agreement, just before we finished the November-December talks. And I think it was to buy himself time to go back for consultations. I don't think he realized he was going to also buy the Christmas bombing.
When the deal was done, did you think, okay,
no,
this
I didn't.
Is great?
I did not like the deal. I foresaw in that agreement the seeds of what happened next. I think in honesty, it was a withdrawal agreement. You know, in diplomacy, sometimes you use euphemistic terms for what it is you've done. I mean, if you look at the agreement, it's called the agreement to restore peace, to end the war and restore peace in Vietnam. Well, it wasn't really that. It turned out essentially to be a withdrawal agreement. The interval ended up not being quite as decent as we would have liked it to be. And then, of course, there's all kinds of discussion afterwards of what, did it unravel because of the agreement, or did it unravel because the presidency was so weakened in those subsequent years that it deprived President Nixon of his ability to react and respond in a forceful way. And, well, you know, we can debate the what-ifs forever.
Let me explain what Nixon and Kissinger's view were, which I shared somewhat a difference with John, and reasonable people can disagree on this. First, we felt that we had, for 10 years, sacrificed blood and money on behalf of South Vietnam. So we have done so much to help them. And we tried to prepare them with Vietnamization. We paid our price. Secondly, we honestly felt it was the best deal we could possibly get. It was better than most people predicted. Most editorials and peace people were saying, coalition government, get rid of Thieu, and so on. We avoided that, thinking we'd give at least a chance for him to survive. There were four reasons we thought the agreement would hold up, beyond thinking we were out of time in any event, that, you know, we've just gone on long enough. Number one, if there were, well, we're not naive. We didn't trust Hanoi. So if they nibbled at the agreement and had some ceasefire violations, we felt that the South Vietnamese, with our supplies, would be able to handle that, that they'd gotten to the point they can handle low-level violations. Number two, if there was massive infiltration and invasion, which did happen, we thought that the American people, certainly we didn't want, and they didn't want us to go back in on the ground, but to uphold an agreement after all these sacrifices and credibility as a world power, at least resume our bombing to stop them from invading. So we thought the military situation could be manageable. Thirdly, there was an aid program. They wanted to call it reparations. We called it reconstruction. And we had aid programs for Laos, Cambodia, and South Vietnam, as well as Hanoi. So that was an incentive. That was the carrot to Hanoi. I think it was $2.5 billion. If they implement the agreement, they get all this aid for reconstruction. And fourthly, we thought that the Chinese and the Russians would weigh in on implementation, not wanting to humiliate us and having their own stakes in the bilateral relationship. Now, each of those assumptions didn't really pan out. The South Vietnamese were not as capable as we hoped, but in all fairness, the Congress, to its eternal shame, cut off economic and military aid, or at least military aid, to the South Vietnamese. So the practical and the psychological impact on our allies of trying to fight off a North Vietnamese invasion when we wouldn't even give them military aid. We're not talking about boots on the ground or even air power. And of course, we couldn't do air power.
And when did Congress cut off aid? Was it any one time or?
Where was it? It got more and more incremental about cutting off bombing, cutting off aid. I don't have all this chronological.
But this was 1973, 1974.
Well, it started in 72 and 3, I mean, and 4, you know, it kept on going. And the archives would have the details. And I must say, Kissinger's book, this is the most comprehensive account, obviously from his perspective, of everything we've talked about and a lot more. So those who are interested in, this came out in 2003. It's called Ending the Vietnam War. So,
but that too is a euphemism, if you pardon the interruption. It ended our involvement in the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the more accurate statement.
Yeah, that's right. So that's why we think it could have worked, but it didn't work because some of these assumptions proved to be wrong. Now, the way we got Thieu to go along was the kind of rationale I just told you. And of course, we couldn't back up, as well as threats. We were out of patience. It's time to come to an agreement. And he had, of course, objected not only to the fact that there were North Vietnamese in his country, but also he felt he'd been misled about where we were and that we dumped it on him just before our elections. So that's why he reacted the way he did. And he didn't like it 2 months later either. Mm-hmm. So that's why we thought it could work, why we felt that we wouldn't get a better deal. And it didn't work out, obviously, the way we hoped. But the fact is we did buy some time. Southeast Asia had time to assemble itself and not fall as dominoes. But it was purchased at a very tough price.
Are there any final thoughts about all of this?
I'm going to get Dick back in here.
Final thoughts?
What did we learn from Vietnam? What were the successes? What were the failures? What do you take away as the lessons the nation should learn?
I think the main lesson is don't get involved in things where you cannot count on your public being fully committed. Because our problem, and I want to stress this again, I've said it before, but I want to stress it again, our problems were not only in Vietnam. Our problems were in the United States. For some odd reason, and maybe some not so odd reason, we were unable to convince the American people that there was a genuine American stake in this conflict. And why we were not able to convince them, what that meant to them, and how we could have done it is one of the great questions of the century, and I suspect that your book does not fully answer it. And I'm not sure that anybody can fully answer it. But I teach a course in diplomacy at Georgetown University. And one of the things I go into, not in the kind of painstaking detail that we do here, but one of the things I go into is the question of how does one handle the problem of public opinion in a democracy when you're dealing with a diplomatic situation. And when you're dealing with people who are smart and as dedicated as the North Vietnamese turned out to be, you have a genuine problem. And you cannot solve it simply by glib memos and sending papers around and taking a lot of trips. You have to solve it by convincing people that what is at stake is genuinely in the national interest. And there were times when we were able to do this, and there were times when we were not able to do that. And I think that is the real question that the Americans face in the coming years and in the coming century, because we have a very, very difficult situation in terms of projecting power across the world in a very, very complex environment. And that is what we have to learn to do. I think if there's anything that comes to me out of this discussion, and I think John and Wynne have handled it brilliantly, if you pardon my saying so, and you asked exactly the right question. The real issue is how does one manage public opinion in a democracy in such a way that one doesn't cheat people? Don't ever think for a moment that you can cheat them, because you can't. You have to do it honestly, you have to do it honorably, but you also have to do it right. And it is one of the questions which I address with my students, how in God's green earth can you sometimes do this? And I hate to say that, but even though, of course, it's an excellent and brilliant course managed by a wonderful professor, we don't have the answer in this course. And I'm not sure that anybody does.
Your students even know anything about Vietnam. I would think it's ancient history to them.
It's ancient history to them, but they can be introduced to the elements of difficulty that you had. And it is a difficult thing to do, particularly when you're dealing with somebody who is as clever and as motivated as the Vietnamese were, and still perhaps are. Now they have a different problem with the Chinese, but that I'm happy to let them worry about. It is, however, something that I think needs a total commitment of American thought and conscience, how we continue this, because
well said.
The world is not going to get simpler.
No.
And there we are.
Well said. John, what are your final thoughts?
Well, several things. I guess
First of all, that was more or less the beginning of my career, not the end of it. And,
yes.
So I went on, and I ended up dealing with situations like Iraq and Afghanistan. I was ambassador to Iraq, and so I in Central America. I was in a lot of different conflictive situations. So I carried my recollections of Vietnam with me wherever I went. And I suppose one of the most important things was Vietnamization. And the fact of building local, the Guam Doctrine, building local capacity, the whole issue of can we do it all ourselves? Can we be the policemen of the world, or do we have to have friends in this endeavor? So I always have, ever since Vietnam, emphasized this aspect. I remember sitting in my office as ambassador of the United Nations with George Tenet when he was head of CIA, and we'd just gone in to Afghanistan, and I told him, we've got to build up the Afghan army. And he just sort of shrugged it off. I mean, we didn't try to do that for another 6 or 7 years, which I think is really unfortunate. So I hope we don't have to keep relearning this lesson when we want to try to help other countries in difficult situations. The second thing I'd say is that obviously what ensued from this, and I think we need to be fair to Mr. Nixon and Mr. Kissinger, even though they're the ones who ended it, they don't really get responsibility. You can't just tag them with responsibility for everything that went before, because I think, in fact, their strategy was quite brilliant, and it would have been better if we'd applied it even sooner. For example, I think the entire LBJ administration, they never really thought through the implications of the Sino-Soviet split, which I think Henry and President Nixon did very thoroughly. Obviously. And lastly, sort of on a happy note, despite the loss of Vietnam to the North, despite all the human tragedy that ensued for boat people, Vietnamese who migrated here, and so forth, I found it very interesting when I went back as Deputy Secretary of State, first time that I'd been back to Vietnam in 35 years since the signing of the agreement, and just saw the incredible enthusiasm that existed in the Democratic Republic of Vietnam for good relations for the United States. And I think it's mutual. And I remember leaving Hanoi, and I gave a press conference, as I would always do whenever I made an official stop somewhere. And a Vietnamese journalist asked me, Mr. Ambassador, if an American oil rig was attacked by the Chinese in Vietnamese-controlled waters, would the United States come to our assistance? Well, you know, when you think of that, that such a question was even conceivable back 40 years ago. We've come a long way, and I find it heartening that we've actually come back to having a healthy relationship with the Democratic Republic of Vietnam.
Well, I think what we've just said is what I think it was Tyler Randall said, but someone can correct me, that you don't have permanent friends or permanent enemies, you have permanent interests. And we have come full circle with Vietnam, and we might come full circle again. The fact is, just a few years after the Paris Peace Accords, the Chinese invaded Vietnam, and they had real conflicts over Cambodia and all kinds of things. For me personally, it was the beginning of my career. All of us were pretty young then. And when I was Assistant Secretary under Clinton in the early 1990s, we were very consumed with the MIA question, who was still missing, getting remains back. So the President appointed me and the Deputy Head of the Veterans Administration, Herschel Goldberg, co-chair of a presidential commission. We took several trips to Hanoi. You can imagine the memories I had to try to find out more about the missing and get the remains. We made a lot of progress, and one of the most emotional and moving moments of my life would be to stand in the Hanoi airport, and it was out of our efforts to see coffins going back to the United States with remains of people who didn't know where their loved ones were for 15 or 20 years. We decided that we would move ahead to try to normalize relations with Vietnam, and for me it was holding my nose, because these guys had broken the agreement and all the sacrifices we had made. But I felt, but more importantly, the administration felt, that was the best way to get information on the MIAs. Secondly, it would help to balance China, which is growing as a geopolitical competitor, because Vietnam, we cleared by then, we're not a great friend of China. Thirdly, we'd have more influence in Southeast Asia. And eventually, Vietnam's an important country, a lot of people in it. Economically, it might be useful down the road. And with the help of people like Senator McCain and Senator Kerry, now foreign minister and head of the Foreign Relations Committee, and Senator Bob Kerry and a congressman named Pete Peterson, they protected Clinton's flank to go ahead with normalization, because Clinton was vulnerable having evaded the draft. So these war heroes and prisoners of war stood up for normalization. And we then normalized relations in 1996. And then since then,
they led the way, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But Clinton had to go ahead, yeah. And he had the cover. So then we normalized, and then we have what John says, the now situation in the South China Sea, where Vietnam's not going to become our ally, but they do see the need for reassuring American presence in that region, as do all the other countries of the region.
If I could add my final thoughts, I have two. One, the debate that we've had, you could have today about the foreign policy of the United States today and the place of America in the world. We're still talking about a lot of the same issues, public support for what's increasingly unpopular war. Do you go back in and bomb if someone does not abide by the agreement? What happens to safe havens across borders? These are all the same issues we're facing today. But the other thing I must conclude with is, as I listen to the three of you talking about with enormous depth and feeling and concern and integrity and honesty and no naivete, and the way you helped conduct foreign policy during a period of enormous crisis in the United States, constitutional crisis, people on the streets, and dealing with one of the most intractable problems, I really must say it was an honor to serve with such great men. And thank you very much for sharing your perspective with all of us and for putting it down for history, because I think people can learn a lot from what you've done for your nation. With that, thank you very much.
In 1972, countries around the world were crippled by crises. The Troubles flared in Northern Ireland.
Military helicopters ferried the guerrillas and their hostages to...
Terror took center stage at the Munich Olympics. War-weary troops soldiered on in Vietnam. Tensions between the East and West called for deft diplomacy. Two men, President Richard Nixon and National Security Affairs Assistant Henry Kissinger, set an ambitious agenda.
At the end of 72, we thought we had the international situation in as favorable a shape for the United States as it had been for a long time.
Together, these men forged a U.S. foreign policy that would change the world. And for that reason, they were named Time Magazine's Men of the Year.
When you and the President were named Men of the Year, did that change anything? And did that...
No, for me it was a nightmare. I was a presidential assistant. To be given equal treatment with the President of the United States was, for me, almost suicidal. And I begged the editor-in-chief at the time to not make me co-man of the year. And I called him several times, and finally he said, "If you call me once more, we make you the sole man of the year." It was, of course, a great privilege, even though I would have preferred not to be named.
Now, my understanding is that the President himself was not particularly pleased to be sharing the honor with anyone else.
I don't know whether he was. He never said it to me, which was the most dangerous aspect of it.
So as you think back to the incredible events of 1972, do you remember that as an era of triumph more or of trial?
It really was both. We thought the war in Vietnam had been ended. We had made progress with established adversaries. A visit to Beijing, visit to Moscow. We achieved our major foreign policy objectives, but it was done under very painful circumstances. The country was very divided over the Vietnam War. So then Watergate blew up, and so the hopes of late 72 couldn't be realized.
As you look back on that year, the sort of rapid development that has come to China and that took off really in the era of Deng Xiaoping. Could you have imagined that back in 1972?
No. Nixon came in February 72. China was still a very underdeveloped country at the time. We had to bring all the technology for the communications of the president. There were no skyscrapers, of course. There were no traffic jams because there were no cars. The hotel in which we stayed in Shanghai, it was like a Howard Johnson. If anyone had thought 30 years later there would be reflections about when China would catch America, or maybe even surpass it, that would have seemed fantastic. The art of leadership is to operate at the outer limit of what a society can achieve. I'm very hopeful and very positive about the prospects before us. And now I have to leave you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.